Oh, Ren Lardner Jr. Is your nickname Bud?
Yeah.
He said, say hi to Bud.
Oh, yeah. He's a good guy. Does he just have a book out?
He has a novel, his first novel.
Oh, wait a minute. That's right. Right. I heard about that. Yeah. What's the name of it?
All for Love, and it's about a brilliant scientist who comes up with a hormone to create love, which he can either inject or administer orally. And it's funny. It's cute. It's not bad. And he is such an interesting guy.
Yeah.
That we wound up talking for a long time.
He's a really nice man. A decent man.
I have a few questions I want to ask you. I guess because Victor Nevasky and the Nation lost this copyright suit and now has to pay $12,500, I guess what Nevasky is going to pay you is going to be cut to the high one figures. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that. We've all been worried with that judgment, which doesn't sound like a lot to most people. I mean, in fact, it was obvious when they first did it that suing Nevasky for $12,500 in an era when an unfairly dismissed busboy wouldn't think of suing for less than $1 million was trying to make him out to be not just a thief, but a small-time thief. But then when you think about it, $12,500, I'm a little afraid he's going to start docking each payment. I'll end up with very little left.
Yeah, it does sound funny, the amount, $12,500, but I think in the suit there must have been a feeling that Victor and the Nation should be shown some compassion.
Oh, I don't think so. I think, in fact, they tried to get lawyers' fees, which would have done in the Nation completely. I think it was the amount of money that they were being paid by Time, or the part that they lost when Time decided not to run the serialization of President Ford's book because the Nation had spilled the beans after Sticky Fingers Nevasky stole the manuscript. But it's the first time that Time has acknowledged that its circulation is precisely the same as the Nation and the same people.
Since
it was in the Nation, and Time assumed that its readers would no longer be interested, you can only assume that everybody who reads Time reads the Nation, right?
Well, that was certainly $12,500 worth of publicity for the Nation. I mean, can you imagine if the Time had just ignored it? Most people have never even heard of the Nation. Most people, with all disrespect, of course, you drop mentions of Victor Nevasky in the Nation, and admittedly, in the literary community and people who have some leftist interest, the Nation is of importance. But can you imagine back in your hometown of Kansas City? Can you imagine how many people don't read the Nation there?
Well, that's been a little problem for me because somebody in Boston asked me what sort of magazine the Nation was. I said, Pinko. I suppose you'd have to say it's a Pinko magazine. And he said, well, surely you have more to say about it than that. And I said, well, it's a Pinko magazine printed on very cheap paper, so that if you make a photocopy of your piece, the photocopy is an awful lot better than the original. I've admitted that the reason I write for The Nation is simply because it's the closest magazine to my house. I think it could be embarrassing in Kansas City, cause a lot of embarrassment to my mother. Fortunately, she knows how to handle these things because people know that I write for The Nation, but as you suggest, they're not very familiar with The Nation. And my mother has told everybody it's a tennis magazine. That seems to satisfy them.
Mm-hmm. What has been the atmosphere around the Nation? So you're doing a regular column for the Nation. You have for many years, and in fact, with all disrespect, is made up of columns that have appeared in the Nation. So what seems to be the atmosphere around the Nation magazine as a result of the Supreme Court decision?
Oh, I haven't been there since the decision. I'm afraid to go there because I'm afraid they'll be asking for donations. So I've stayed away. It's not that close to my house.
All right, Calvin Trillin. Let's talk about a couple of the things that you mention in with all disrespect, some of the topics that you have thought about and decided to include. For example, one of the things that amused me a little bit was the Forbes magazine 400 richest people in America, and you had speculated about the people who have been left out of that list.
Well, I was particularly concerned with the 401st richest man in the country. I have a lot of compassion for the rich. A lot of people don't worry about them much, but I do. And I see him as this guy who lives at the Carlisle and dates models and goes to these really expensive French restaurants with these fashion models who weigh maybe 78 pounds, probably 12 of it in cheekbones. Suddenly they come out with this list and he's not on it. He's humiliated. Can't go back to these restaurants. They'll give him a table near the kitchen and the swinging door will blow the fashion model into the dessert tray. He doesn't, he's afraid to show up at the Regency where they have breakfast and make deals that they'll kind of chew up a small company for him before they pass it over to him to swallow, like an Eskimo mother pre-chewing the meat or something. He's going to be condescended to by all these people. So, yeah, I have a lot of worry about him in the same way I have concern over the 501st largest corporation, the guy who didn't make the Fortune 500 list. Think of that. Come to some town where Humboldt Bolton Steel has been chugging away for all these years, doing their very best, breaking unions and bribing foreign governments and shortcutting environmental regulations, trying their best to make it. They're 501st, and somebody says, do you have any Fortune 500 companies in this town? Think about how old Harry Humboldt of Humboldt Bolton Steel feels. He's 501st. So I have a lot of compassion for these people.
It's like being number 11 on the best dressed list. I always wondered about how they decide that. You know, usually the recently there was a list of people, this is not in your book, of course, but there was a list of people who were supposed to be the fathers of the year, the 10 best fathers. I think Mario Cuomo was a number one father. I think Jimmy Breslin was on it. Maybe he wasn't. I can't remember. Somebody was on it who only had one kid. And Charles Osgood here at CBS, he was on it. He has four or five or six. And you just wonder what criteria.
Planned Parenthood does it. That's put all those guys with six children on the list and show how miserable they are.
It has to be some sort of public relations firm trying to figure out how we can milk this thing, you know, have a big to-do out of it. And because if some guy in Iowa that nobody's ever heard of has 30 kids, you know, and he doesn't make it, he may be the best father in the world, but he's not going to come to the Hilton and get an award.
I've always assumed that most of those lists, particularly things like the best dress list, really should be called the 10 most active public relations people lists. The 10 people who have the most active flacks are the ones who are on the list, ranked 1 to 10.
Get a free meal out of it, though, if you're on the list.
That's right. You might have to give a free speech for the free meal.
My tuxedo. You go into some detail about your tuxedo, and I notice you are not wearing one today.
I am not wearing it today, but this is the sort of occasion where I might wear my tuxedo. Mm-hmm. I wear it more often than people normally wear tuxedos. What happened is that I bought my tuxedo in college. I was a thrifty young undergraduate, and I divided the number of times I might have to wear a tuxedo into the cost of a tuxedo, and I came out thinking that it would be cheaper to buy one than to rent one. It hadn't even occurred to me that I might be wearing one after I got out of college. So now, every time I wear it, the cost goes down. And as I've said, I wear it sometimes when people ordinarily might not wear tuxedos, to hog roasts, say, or brisses, or meetings to plan the violent overthrow of the government, something like that. Now my tuxedo's down to something like 48 cents a wearing. To try to rent a tuxedo for 48 cents these days, you can't do it. So when I meet the people who were in my college class who are Wall Street financiers, the lower third of my college class are all millionaires on Wall Street, occasionally I meet one of them and he says, what are you doing? And I say, I'm amortizing my tuxedo. Makes me feel that I'm playing in the big leagues.
I had a white dinner jacket once, which I wore for many years, kept in the closet, and I wore it one day, and guy came up to me and he said, you know, yellow is not in style.
I had a white dinner jacket that was lost, and I'm not quite sure where it got lost, but I'm afraid it would be a yellow dinner jacket, too, now.
And with a double-breasted, too, and I don't know if people wear double-breasted dinner jackets anymore. Don't you have problems with the lapels on your tuxedo if you got it back? You
know, I don't have problems. The people who name the 10 best dressed lists probably have problems with the lapels on my tuxedo, but they don't present any problems with me. They keep the dust off.
You are from Kansas City, so you have... One of the essays that you have included is called How to Pronouncing Missouri. Or is it, am I pronouncing it correctly?
You certainly aren't. Uh-huh. No, as a matter of fact, you'd probably be censored if you were in Missouri and you said what you had just said. The right way to pronounce Missouri is Missouri, as you can tell, as if it's spelled M-I-S-S-O-U-R-A. And in fact, until I was about 12, I thought that's the way it was spelled. Nobody ever said anything different. I suspect my teacher thought it was spelled that way. Some people in St. Louis pronounce it Missouri, but they don't understand very well. St. Louis, actually, if you divided the country right, would be in Illinois, as you probably know. I've always divided the country. Regionalism is a big thing now, and I've always divided the country into two regions. Cities that had Major League Baseball before the Second World War and cities that didn't. The cities that have Major League Baseball are kind of the ancien United States. And St. Louis is the southwest corner. And it belongs on the other side of the Mississippi. So it's not properly in Missouri anyway. So it's no surprise that they would know how to pronounce it.
Why did they put Kansas City on the wrong side of the line? It should be in the Kansas side, shouldn't it?
No, they didn't put Kansas City on the wrong side of the line. They named the state next to it the wrong name. They named that state Kansas. That state should have been called something like Nebraska.
But Kansas City, Kansas, nobody pays any attention to. Might as well not be there. And
that's right. Yeah. I'm not even sure if it still is. But it was last time I was home, I have to tell you that.
I'm from Kansas, you know. So we and my mother's from Missouri, so we have some Midwestern roots in common. But I haven't been back for, let's see... 47 years. Has it changed?
Not much. Depends on your town. What town is it?
Wichita.
Wichita hasn't changed much, no. Actually, Wichita has changed quite a bit. They've got tall buildings now in Wichita.
They have one.
Yes, they have tall buildings, and they have places where you can get liquor by the drink, which wasn't true 47 years ago. If you buy a share in the liquor pool of the club in the motel, you can get a drink. I know somebody in Kansas who says when he dies, the major part of his estate is going to be shares and liquor pools around various parts of the state. Wichita has changed a bit, but there are places in Kansas that haven't changed much in the last 47 years.
Now, residents of Kansas City, Missouri, they certainly don't drive across the state line into Kansas to buy a drink, do they?
I used to when I was in high school, as a matter of fact, because Kansas was then just coming out of being completely dry, and they served 3.2 beer, but they served it at age 18. We weren't 18, but we were closer to 18 than we were to 21, which was the drinking age in Missouri. So we used to drive across the line, and for that reason, I've always associated Kansas with wickedness.
Yeah, I still do, trying to live that down. Confessions of a Duke. Now, this one interested me a lot because Jerzy Kosinski interests me, and I tried to reach Jerzy Kosinski because what I wanted to do was to go out with him at night, you know, take a tape recorder and go out. I understand he lurks in dark alleys and doorways and things like that.
Somewhere.
And I asked my boss if they could give me the day off the next day so I could stay up late and go out with Jerzy Kosinski. Well, I was told by his publicist over at Bantam, or NAL, that he's working hard on a new novel, and which, of course, raises all sorts of questions right there,
right.
And that he could not go out with me at night to do this. So apparently he is inside at night doing something with regard to this novel. Anyway, I'll just throw that over to you. What do you mean exactly when you say Confessions of a Dupe?
Well, this is... When one of my girls came home from school one day looking very upset and said that one of the children had said I was a dope of the communists. And I said, not dope, dupe. She had defended me by saying I wasn't really a dope of a communist, although I did dopey things occasionally. And what she was talking about was whether I had been taken in by a wicked Polish communist who, according to the New York Times, had been spreading a lot of tales about Jerzy Kosinski. And all this had to do with a literary dispute, I suppose you'd call it, which started with the New York Times running a rather gushy front page of the magazine article on Jerzy Kosinski that was written more or less in a style I would think of as associated with Silver Screen, and included a lot of stories from him that are what I believe the intellectuals call Easter Bunny stuff. That is, things that were pretty hard to believe were accepted pretty much as truth. And then the Village Voice later wrote a piece saying that Jerzy Kosinski had some help on his book. My daughter thought it was more or less the sort of help that she'd like to get on her homework if she could find anybody in the house who understood mathematics. He objected to this, although not specifically point by point. And the Times, I think, was very embarrassed at all the Easter Bunny stuff. So they ran a long piece saying that all of those people who had written about this were dupes of the communists, specifically this one wicked Polish communist who is devoting his entire efforts. Apparently the communists are not worried about Solzhenitsyn, they're worried about Jerzy Kosinski. And I was one of them, of these communists. I felt I wasn't as much of a dupe as some. But we finally decided that the person who probably started the rumor that Jerzy Kosinski didn't write his own books was Jerzy Kosinski, which was because that way he could get paid for them without being blamed for them, which I thought was very clever, and if so, I really am a dupe.
You also have some other literary touches, and with all due respect, these are the novelists who have a motif associated with them, dressing up, for example, like John Irving as a wrestler, Norman Mailer in boxers.
Well, this is really what this has really happened. This very same article, which I believe is now called the Easter Bunny article. I said at the time that the reporter, Barbara Gelb, was very fortunate that Kosinski didn't tell her that he was, in fact, the long-lost Princess Anastasia. But this very article carried on the cover of the New York Times magazine a picture of Kosinski without a shirt on in half of a polo-playing costume. Apparently he's a member of the Polish polo team, or was. And then I noticed on the inside cover of the New Yorker one day an ad for Vanity Fair, John Irving, in his wrestling costume. And I realized there might be a trend of novelists posing without their shirts on, which I find alarming. I don't think Henry James ever did that, as far as we know. Hemingway might have. Then it occurred to me that pretty soon they'll be standing in line, and you'll see Norman Mailer in his boxing trunks, and Philip Roth in his jockey shorts, and pretty soon it'll be kind of expected of novelists. So that.
What about Erica Jong?
Well, I didn't go into that part, as we say. I was just worried that it would get so that some conglomerate would swallow up Isaac Singer's publisher and call him in and say, welcome aboard, Isaac. What's your sport? And Singer would say, well, I do a little Talmudic hair splitting now and then just to keep my hand in. And then he would wonder if on very warm days in Warsaw in the rabbi's court, if perhaps everybody didn't pray simply in a tallis without any kind of shirt on at all. So I think it's an alarming trend, and I hope it stops.
Incidentally, just to digress, Erica Jong stood me up. You know, she had a book out last year called Parachutes and Kisses. And while I was invited to the pub party somewhere down in the village, that happened to be on the same day that she was coming in for the interview. And I was supposed to talk to her at 4 o'clock. So I got a call from the publicist, and the publicist said, Erica would like to change the date of the interview because you're supposed to talk to her at 4, and she has the party at 6, and she needs more than 2 hours to get dressed. And I said, 2 hours to get dressed? You know, it only takes her 30 seconds to get undressed. The publicist thought that was very funny and must have relayed it to Erica, because I never was able to reschedule that.
That was the end of that interview.
I have.
Well, that'll teach you to be a smart aleck.
It's strange. I went to college with her lawyer, who has handled her divorce and harassment charges against her ex-husband and all of this. And I had mentioned that. That Erica had stood me up, and he said, well, he was having lunch with Erica the next day, and he would mention that and make sure that she called me and reset the appointment. But that never happened, so I couldn't even call on an old college chum to bring her out.
Now, she didn't exactly stand you up. She didn't make an appointment and then not show. She just refused to reschedule it, in a way.
Well, she didn't show up that day.
Oh, the 4 o'clock one.
The publicist did head me off. I mean, I didn't sit here with an open mic, so, I mean, there was a certain amount of courtesy involved.
Right.
Well, I suppose we could... I did want to mention one thing. I think it's... And I think this is a disservice that you have done in your book. This is when you write about the beautiful parking spots, and you specifically make mention of NYP plates. Now, it would seem to me that having writers like yourself mention that there is such a thing as an NYP plate, is doing those of us with NYP plates great disservice. You know, it was only a year ago that Jimmy Breslin began to attack NYP plates.
Well, you know, I didn't know that Breslin had done that until I mentioned it to somebody as the final verboten subject in the New York Press. That is, that the New York Times or CBS would be more likely to do a story on military movements during war than to mention NYP plates, and particularly true of these institutions that love to talk about the shocking privilege of these congressmen who push decent folks off airplanes in order to get to parties in New York. And here they are with NYP plates. It's very odd. Those of us who represent the Parkers, as an ex-co-editor of Beautiful Spot, a magazine of parking, I feel strongly about this. And what I wanted to do, and I haven't seen Breslin's column, but I think he would be a wonderful person to start it, and that is to devote one column a month on people who have NYP plates and don't seem to cover fires. I would suggest the first one be on William Paley, as a matter of fact, who has NYP plates on his limousine, unless, of course, between now and then he starts covering fires.
You realize what you just said will not appear on the air.
I think that's safe to assume.
Well,
yes.
You know, I after Jimmy came out with that column, which was a lot more angry than yours, of course, I proposed that what we should do is send him a couple of NYP plates to put on his car. You know, once he has them, he won't say anything about it.
Well, I actually, now that I know that Breslin mentioned this in a column, I think that he should get either the Pulitzer Prize or be put in the federal witness program to keep his kneecaps from being broken or something like that. It's a remarkably courageous thing to do. I do wonder why Malcolm Forbes needs NYP plates.
Well, he needs a place to park his car on the street.
Well, see, what I was worried, now that it's known that NYP plates have nothing at all to do with covering the news.
Well, whoever said they did?
Well, they don't, obviously. But no, what worries me is that when other people find this out, that other industries, just as important to the economy of New York as the communications industry, will want their own plates. So you'll have NYRES plates for New York Real Estate Shark, or garment industry plates, that sort of thing, Wall Street mogul plates, NYWSM plates. Pretty soon, all of the common parkers, our constituents, after all, in beautiful spot of magazine of parking, will be circling the block.
Well, I have to state a certain amount of reality, Calvin, that the common parker seems to have no difficulty in parking in the NYP zones. Because every time I try to use an NYP zone, it's filled up with common cars out there. New Jersey.
Doesn't
plates.
He get a ticket?
People from Pennsylvania.
Well, here's one of the more June aspects of NYP plates is some people who have New Jersey license plates have NYP plates.
Well, they could deserve it, but what's really funny are the people who have Connecticut NYP plates. Now, they're just vanity plates. At least in New York and New Jersey, there are supposed to be controls. You're supposed to be affiliated, and you have to have some job with a communications firm, even if it's in newspaper circulation.
What would the reason be that I'm sure Breslin would be better at talking about this than I, since he's treated it as properly as a subject for expose. But why would it be that people at CBS or NBC should have parking privileges and people at, say, Kuhn Loeb shouldn't, or people at, say, the American Metal Standards Company?
Well, I think they ought to have their own plates and their own places.
And their own little places.
That's right.
I like that. That's a democratic attitude.
But you have to, but just think about this. Just think, you have to show some compassion. What if you happen to be a $350,000 a year radio anchor man?
Right.
And you have to get up in the middle of the night to come to work.
Yeah.
Don't you think that he should be able to park close to his microphone and not have to drive around the block looking for either a free place, of which there are none in Midtown Manhattan, or actually put it in a garage and at the end of the day wind up paying $35?
I should think that he wouldn't have much trouble at 2 in the morning. When did you say he got here? There's usually quite a few. I've come up here to park at some of those late shows. I don't seem to have any problems.
Do you have NYP plates?
No, indeed.
Well, you know, to keep you from writing any more about this subject,
right,
I'm going to talk to the press club and have them send you a set of NYP plates.
No, I would send them. Breslin and I are pure as the driven snow, and we would send them back.
I suppose you would. At least you don't get angry about it. Well, listen, Calvin, we can keep going on and on and on. But I think I have more material here than I need, and I'm sure you have better things to do than sit here and make fun of people with NYP plates. Causes trouble, difficult. You know, it took me years to get NYP plates,
and now they're
about to be taken away from me.
And now, when you put the part about William Paley on the air, that will be the end of them. They'll take them away from you, right?
It will also be the end of BookBeat.
The end of all of us. We will all disappear.
When are you going to do another novel?
I don't know. I don't seem to have one cooking in my left ear. One of these days, I guess. I'm thinking about it. I'm going to do something this summer. At least I'm going to start something. Because I have a kind of a period of time in Nova Scotia.
Is that where you're vacationing?
Yeah.
Why Nova Scotia?
Oh, we just happened to go up there after our first child was born a long time ago. We had some friends in Canada, and we had been to odd places in the summer, and we knew that was not possible to go to Africa or something, but we kind of wanted to get out of the country. And we just happened to go up there, not intending to buy anything or anything. We liked it and happened to see a nice little fishing village, and we thought, wouldn't it be nice if there was some place for sale? And we went down the back road and bought the place. And
you drive up?
Yeah.
If you had NYP plates, you could park anywhere you wanted to in that little fishing village without any problem.
Yeah, that would... I'd also have a little trouble explaining NYP plates if I had them.
Most people think that I'm a police officer somehow,
which can
be dangerous.
Right. That's what's going to happen eventually. The whole population will turn on the NYP plates.